Hello and welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast for the week of the 14th of May 2015. Your weekly review of all things cycling. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, it's a go-go at the Giro with a frenetic opening five stages and no shortage of action. We're going to be overwhelmed just trying to capture a fraction of what's going on, but we'll try our best. The AmGam Tour of California is in full swing, notwithstanding an absence of any big American names. But with Mount Baldy just a few days away, it's nicely poised. And well, back to the Giro d'Italia again. We'll give you our best analysis, which admittedly will be fairly limited on the next five stages of racing in Italy as we approach the first rest day. That's all in this week's show. And with me, Phil Gomes and Ride Media's Rob Arnold. Guys, welcome aboard.
Hey.
The Good Ship podcast is going again. Rob, it's good to have you back.
I missed a week last week. Busy on a deadline. We finished a magazine yesterday, which was a huge relief. And now it's time to make a tour guide. So back, busy.
And a magazine. So, that one you do sort of almost...
We do. It's too much. I don't know. No, it's been an interesting few weeks.
So it's basically two solid months of production, right? Yep, to push out the quarterly plus the tour guide.
Yes.
So how many pages is that?
About 480 or so.
It's a few books worth, basically.
Yeah. And a lot. Right. And there's a lot of cycling, but it's always challenging and fun.
And compounded even more so, I suppose, considering... I mean, I think you were sort of posting on Facebook about the fact that, you know, just as you're going to deadline, these sort of large events seem to always happen, and you sort of
get... We'd done a nice little feature, a review of the seven Aussies who had worn the pink jersey, and then there were eight.
Yeah.
You know, for example.
Yeah. How many pages did you throw out then?
No. We don't throw things out. We just shuffle here, shuffle there. Yeah. It's a planning exercise, and keeps you awake at night, but then then when you finish, you feel quite happy. It's just like any rewarding job, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I was going to say, the website keeps you awake at all. That's for a different reason. All right, guys, let's get into it, and we'll first up start with the AmGam Tour of California. Well, we thought we'd start with the AmGam Tour of California, mainly because it's the race that is going on elsewhere other than the Giro, which really has captured everyone's attention. And I feel like not many people have been... It's kind of been in that sort of background. I mean,
I've seen the last 5 kilometres of the stages. Does that count?
Yeah.
I don't consider that to be watching cycling, so no, I'm not going to contribute much to this.
But so far, that pretty well amounts to the full sum of the... AmGam Tour of California.
What is with you and AmGam?
Etix, AmGam.
You really have a problem with pharmaceutical companies, don't you?
Exactly. Right? It's always about the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
But just to recap what actually has gone on before we go into it, the Women's Tour of California, AmGam, the Women's AmGam Tour of California, that was 3 days, three stages. That was I believe it's a new edition this year, a really good edition. Velozio SRAMs. Trixie Warwick was the winner, and she won on the final stage by picking up bonus seconds. So it was a pretty thrilling finish there for Trixie Warwick to win over Leah Kirkman. And in the men's race, well, we don't have a TJ Van Garderen because he's not in California this year. And I think that's probably a good move for him in terms of preparing for the Tour de France. We don't have an Andrew Talansky either because he pulled out after stage one with allergies, which means it's an interesting sort of race without America's two big stars. Even so, we had some pretty thrilling action on stage three, particularly with a young Estonian, I believe, Tom Skugens.
Skugens, yep.
I was practicing that name this morning just in case.
Solo victories, they're always nice, aren't they?
Yeah, look, you know, the Hincapie development team, obviously, it's job done for them, really, as far as this tour is concerned. They just need to hang on. But this kid looks like he could hang on, potentially.
But what's interesting, at least.
Yeah, that's right. But what's interesting to me is context. If we look at the two races on the two different continents, right, we've got a number of 23 and 22-year-olds winning stages against good competition in big races. Right, that's pretty cool, and they really look like children. Or am I getting old?
No, we'll get to the Giro in a minute because I think that's what you're talking about.
But also Skugens as well.
He looks,
you know,
about,
he's a real
12.
Baby face. He looks about 12, kind of like Esteban Chavez. You know, it's like, you know, very very They look like boys.
Yeah.
I'm getting old.
No, they are. And
even Sagan, who we've become accustomed to seeing for a few years, he was born in 1990, wasn't he?
Yeah, so. Yeah. And he's always got that sort of... Well, he, for a while, he used to have that really wispy yeah. facial hair. I remember, you know...
I've just become a man.
So apologies to Skugens. He's actually Latvian, not Estonian.
That's right.
But in some title, we've had four stages so far, heading into, I suppose, the race proper. But Mark Cavendish picked up a couple after some very nice lead-outs from... Mr. Mark Renshaw, yep. And Wout Wippert's been in the action from Drapac Professional Cycling, who you're a big fan of, Phil. And, of course, Peter Sagan picked up the fourth stage, finally got his win. I feel like he really was angry.
That was a long time in coming, but it was spectacular. I thought he handled it really well. And then to be wheeling as he crosses the line, you know, that's a bit of fun. Cycling needs a little bit of fun.
We totally need that.
He's a showman, and I feel like we've missed some of that because he's... Some of his confidence has been totally shattered in the last sort of 6 to 12 months by just not being that dominant force that he was in his younger years.
Is that the beginning of the re-beginning?
The re-beginning of the beginning?
I don't know.
Well, you know, it's kind of like the race of confidence building for Sagan and for Cavendish. Mm. Let's put it that way. I think... you know, they're there to pick up wins, and they're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, which is only going to be good for them. But it's going to be interesting to see them, you know, in a Grand Tour field at the Tour de France and see how that plays out, see what the difference is there.
Mm. How do you watch sprints when Cavendish is there? Like the first two stages, for example, it's like, okay, well, we pretty much know what's going to happen here. There is anticipation because there's a bit of elbowing and a bit of pushing and a bit of headbutting there and positioning. But when he's up like he was in stages one and two, you pretty much know the result.
Yeah, but you know what? You know, I get a lot of joy out of watching the way they set it up and, you know, then the lead out from Renshaw, who carries so much speed in the last couple of hundred that basically Cav just comes off the wheels like a slingshot.
Yeah.
And he's gone.
I think it was stage one particularly. Yeah. Or was it maybe stage two? But Renshaw basically had essentially won the sprint.
The stage, yeah.
And then Cavendish sort of just went past him. But it was...
But that's why we need the cameras on bikes, just to give us the perspective. Because you see Walter Rippert and Graham Brown and the Drapac guys doing their own train. And I was saying this morning, come on, just jump on the Sagan's wheel. But it's not that easy,
No, it isn't. No. And actually...
That's the thing. The sprint looks like it's won in the last 200 when it really it's probably won in the last 5K.
Exactly.
With that sort of... the shouldering, you touch that wind. I think Von Hoff, I spoke to him a long time ago just about the way he was struggling because he was sort of having to do it on his own a lot. And he would say, you know, I'd get to a kilometre to go and I'd be done. And people don't see that. They just see you at a kilometre to go in a seemingly good position, but they don't see the fact that you've essentially sprinted three times in that sort of 5 to 1K period. And that is the art of all of that sort of lead-out stuff, which we don't necessarily see.
The arrival of Renshaw is just, it's phenomenal. The timing of that guy is remarkable. He just, you know, you can sort of see other teams and you see all of the American domestic teams having a real crack and really putting on a show to try and get the lead up, and then 3K to go, here we go.
It's making Renshaw on cue. Mario Cipollini's lead up man for years.
He had a few, but that was 20 years ago. 20,
oh, yeah, okay. All right. Well,
our Sacchi, Fabio Sacchi before this time.
Yeah. That's trying my memory now. But
Giuseppe Calcaterra.
You know, but you could see it was the same kind of setup, you know, for Cavas, for him. Mm. He had that one guy or those, you know, a pair of guys who could really deliver him in the last couple of hundred meters. But, you know, I've been actually impressed by Wippert. Right, because on stage one he finished seventh, but he lost Brownie to a crash, right? Or no, to a flat, right? Early, and he still was in the mix. Mm. But now he's got Brownie. He's had Brownie for the last couple of stages, and he's kind of there.
Yeah,
you know. So it's a testament to how good Graham Brown is.
Graham looked fantastic this morning.
Yeah, he really did.
That's stage four. Just to clarify.
Yeah, that's right. And Wippert is so close to delivering. Really, really close. I mean, he did that at the Tour Down Under on the final stage, but that's really just a street criterium. It's different in a stage, in an actual open road stage. So, and especially when you've got guys like Cavendish and...
The California's a weird race to watch. Is it just me, or does it just feel like you're watching these... The size of the road makes it so unfamiliar. It's just strange territory. Even, you know, I've never been there.
Super highways, aren't they?
Yeah. Really.
It's funny because you look at some of these towns and you sort of... It's kind of like chasms between each side of the street. You know, you've got... You know, these houses on both sides, and then probably like what must be an Olympic swimming pool in distance, you know, between the two sides. Well, it's crazy.
Yeah. Let's consider the end of stage four where Daniel Oss went off at the last kilometre. It was a great move, and he's the type of guy who could have held it off. And he probably looked at the road book and thought, oh, yeah, there's a few turns in the last kilometre. I'm good for it. And then they went into the corners, and I don't think anyone was touching any brakes ever. That's maybe the they had to stop for, they didn't even have to stop pedaling. That was such a wide arc of a turn.
And that definitely changes the way I think you feel about the racing, because, you know, when you compare that to the European racing, you know, the final kilometer of a European race, road furniture, tight streets, you know, it's just, I don't know, it almost makes the American racing feel a lot more sterile.
Yeah, I agree. Yes. You don't have as many heart-in-mouth moments when they're going through a hairpin and the peloton is crunched into a, you know, a 5 meter sort of little lane. I mean, when you're at the Tour of California, it's like, well, they're getting through that corner.
And it's exaggerated when it's running concurrently with the Giro, because like I go to the Tour de France every year and they have plenty of barricades, but they don't have that big fence, you know, the one that they have at the Giro, which is sort of like one of those football fences to stop people leaning over and getting in the rider's way. Yeah. And then that contrasts so strongly with what these big boulevards of California. Yeah. Just it's one must thing, be sprinting bliss, actually. Actually, to have it kind of,
and not you know, I don't want people to take this the wrong way, but it kind of reminded me of, you know, watching stages from the Tour of Azerbaijan. Same thing, big wide open roads, open vistas, that sort of thing, and you still get this very sterile approach. I'm a big fan of nice tight street racing.
All right, just quickly looking ahead before we go into the Giro. Big Bear Lake and Mount Baldy, obviously the key stages. Big Bear Lake may be cancelled pending the snow. Currently, there's a lot of snow up there. If that does happen, then it really is just down to that mountain stage, which may be good in some ways because it might make it more open. But I think California fans would probably prefer to have the TT in there. It's always been a big feature of the race.
So are we just going to assume that Julian Alaphilippe's going to win?
Well, this is what I was going to say.
I mean, that's what I am.
I was looking at the field and I'm going, well, there's no Tlansky, no Van Garder, and there's no Orica Green Edge with someone like a Yates in there who maybe could throw something in there.
There's a couple of Morton brothers, aren't there? I saw Gus on the front earlier today.
It's a bit of a bare cabinet, though. I mean, I think Julian Alaphilippe is an obvious favourite. Peter Kenyuk is probably someone who could mix it up. He's had good form.
That's a good call.
But I don't. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, it's funny when these races when there's just no.
He needs a little bit of pressure.
Yeah,
Peter.
Right.
I had a good chat with him at Down Under, and we were talking about how he manages, you know, expectations, and he says, oh, I don't have that many expectations. There's other people on the team that can do that for me.
So he needs a boot up the bum.
So maybe it'd be cool if they just said,
Isle of Man mentality.
If they cheat him up. Come on, mate, it's yours. It's yours for the taking. Yeah. And see what happens of him. Because I've talked him up in the podcast before. I just think he looks like the best bike rider
in the peloton.
Well,
he's a team skyrider, Rob. I'm joking.
That's an in-joke that I'm not even in on. So if anyone can just phone in and let me know what that was all about, that'd be great.
All right, guys. Let's move on. A reminder to everyone listening, the Amgen Tour of California is live all this week online and on SBS2. The final stage, Sunday. That's Monday morning in Australia. So
just quickly on that, it's cool to watch it in the morning. That makes a massive difference. Wouldn't everyone not agree that that's one of the benefits?
Breakfast cycling. It's the best thing.
Yeah. Breakfast cycling. Well, we've got there in the end, but the Giro d'Italia, well, it's been a fascinating opening 5 days. And I tell you what, it's had the diversity of a small stage race in what's been offered up. We've had a team time trial. We've had a sprint stage. We've had a couple of sort of lumpier ones. And stage five, that was Wednesday in Europe, was an absolute cracker as well. The first mountain summit finish. Green Edge won the team time trial. Elia Viviani from Team Sky, the sprint stage, that was stage 2 to Genova. Then we had the Michael Matthews Bling Train in pink winning his second Giro d'Italia stage, and that was in Sestri Levante. Stage 4, La Spezia, that went to David Formolo, but a third different rider from Australia and a third different rider from Orica Greenhead, Simon Clark, picking up the jersey. That was actually a bit of a cracker in itself, which yep. we'll go into it a bit in a second. And then, of course, Jan Polenc picking up the stage win, but a real foray from the GC riders overnight with Alberto Contador, Fabio Aru, and Richie Porte really going head-to-head in the mountains. Guys, it's... We could probably talk for a long time just about a couple of stages, but maybe just first thoughts on what's happened so far. It's been a bit of a Giro d'Australia, I feel.
Should I start? I can talk a long time about each stage, so I'm going to try and do it quickly.
Maybe just give us your first reflections.
Well,
and we'll
the first thing is how... What a sense of deja vu we had, like, really. I mean, we had the Garmin crash in the team time trial last year, so that sort of influenced the result, I think, a little bit. But I don't know if they would have been barking at OGE's heels. Anyway, but it's cool to see Gero lead the troops home on Saturday. That was an amazing ride. And to have the on-bike camera for Esteban, for Chavez... And just to see him literally last place, and just, you, in other words, you saw the rotation of everyone else pulling their turns, and it was really some phenomenal stuff. Michael Hepburn, Luke Durbridge, and Brett Lancaster, these guys are TTT machines, just absolute wizards in that kind of discipline, so it's not surprising to see them win.
And Chavez just keeping himself fresh.
But that's their force, the smoothness of their team time trial is just something to watch. Get that footage from Chavez that you can find from Velon. It's fantastic to watch.
And we should point out that they did that ride without Svein Tuft.
Mm. Exactly.
It was a major power plant for the team on...
The Swain.
What was it? It was 54 point something K an hour for 19 kilometres. Like, that's just...
Yeah,
okay, Wingo's going to do it for an hour, but that's not up and down hill. So.
Apparently upwards of 55. Then we had Viviani win stage 2. But, I mean, sorry, before we sort of start, we won't go too much into those stages, but it's rare, I think we should probably mention this, that we've had... Three riders on the same team, three riders from the same country wearing the leader's jersey to Grand Tour. Other than the...
Matt Keenan was saying it was 1982 that the last time that happened. I thought LPR had three guys from in the pink a couple of years ago.
But maybe not from
I don't remember any of them.
Maybe not from the same country or... Because I think there was he was saying, you know, Fignon and... I can't remember the third guy that they had. That was the 80. That was the one that he was referencing.
I don't know about LPR, by the way, but I was just sort of thinking. I thought there'd been a couple since.
Well, they had DeLuca, Pataki, and who did they have? They had a couple.
So if it was the same team in a Grand Tour, anyway, neither here nor there. If you look back to GBMG, I think Flavio Vanzella and Mario Cipollini in 1994 at the Tour de France, maybe.
With Clarke getting the jersey as well, that was three. But then there was a potential for a fourth with Chavez, but was not to be. I mean, he could have potentially picked it up on stage 5 to Abitone if you had have been in the mix, but it was
just off of the
so,
pace, wasn't it?
So close.
Yeah, but we've seen the three guys who are going to be on the podium unless they crash.
Guys, let's talk about some of the bigger talking points. Oh, sorry, go on, Phil.
I just want to make a small quick detour.
Yep.
Just to talk about Ilya Viviani for a moment.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was he pointing to the sky for? Was that about his
team? Sky?
Team Sky? I don't know. Yeah, but Ilya Viviani has found a very good home in Sky.
Yeah.
Right? I think he's in a perfect team to balance his track and Olympic ambitions.
Definitely.
It's a team that understands those things and his sprint ambitions. He's already had a very good season with Sky this year. I've always liked Viviani as a sprinter, not the fastest guy, but just a terrific guy all around. So I expect him to do a lot more this year with Sky. He's their number one guy for the sprints.
Yeah, right. He was cool. I thought it was interesting. Well, there's so many different things that we can talk about. That's why I said I could talk about each topic for a long time. But one of the big things, if you're talking about Viviani and Sky, and we'll get to Porte eventually, is the fact that there's no Brits at all in the peloton. I think that's quite bizarre.
The British team.
Are there any Americans?
But the British team has always been... I think they've had a bit of a... I know they are at least notionally British, but, I mean, they have always had a bit of an international... character about them. It's sort of similar to Greenedge.
Sky, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, Greenedge after maybe the first year, one of the most diverse teams in the, you know, one of the most cosmopolitan,
but
I suppose.
But does that exaggerate the Australian influence in the first 4 days? I mean, you couldn't ignore the Australian influence, but just the fact that, of course, it doesn't exaggerate it. No, it doesn't.
No,
so
no.
An Australian team won and then three Australians led.
Yeah.
Guys, let's talk about stage. Yeah. Sorry, Rob. Sorry to cut in, but
let's talk about Michael Matthews.
Let's talk about Michael Matthews, but let's
you
talk.
You told me you didn't. We shouldn't be talking too much about Michael Matthews, and here we are talking about another win in the pink jersey.
I never said anything about Michael Matthews.
Do the throw.
Pozzo Vivo's crash, first of all. Ooh. I want to talk about that. One of the big things about that was, well, A, he's out of the race. That's going to have a big impact on the nature of how it all plays out, because he was going to be one of the animators, and I think it's going to change the dynamic of how things play out. But what do you think about the reaction? Suddenly, it was a very serious crash. It had sort of that throwback to the Weyland incident, which, you know,
I don't understand how. I don't know.
There's a sensitivity around these things.
Go for it.
But I mean, do you think was RCS or Italian TV in any were they pushing the barriers a little bit by staying on those shots, do you think? Or
I have to admit I didn't watch that one live. I saw the highlights, so I haven't really seen what the treatment was, but I think that when you see him hit the ground and you know what's happened, you don't really want to see the consequence in the full bloody detail. I think you want to know that he's okay. I think I was a little bit lucky by getting reports from AG2R.
The next day.
Just to say he's okay. Because
then there's not that heart and mouth moment. Phil, I mean, you were...
But it does make you wince and makes you upset. I think most people would be crying when they're watching that, because it's just bloody horrible to see.
But Phil, I mean, what do you make of that? You know, the criticism, you know, I think Froome was very vocal. He said something like, you know, out of respect for the family, they shouldn't be showing this. But then again, equally, should you not be showing it? Because, I mean, like, is it the fact that we're reveling in someone else's pain? Because I don't think anyone would have been doing that. They wouldn't have been reveling in it.
They're still trying to report the news.
Exactly. And that's sort of the nature of what they're trying to be doing.
It's a news event in the context of the race, and it should be shown. That's where I sit with that. I have real problems with the sanitization of media, generally, especially when it comes to coverage of wars and war zones and stuff like that. I think human beings should be able to see the consequences of the things that they do and the consequences of things that happen. And this is just one of them. I don't think we should be spared seeing those things and understanding what they are about. Mm. And as such, they are news. And anyone who argues that they're not news is, as far as I'm concerned, wrong.
Yeah. Let's not pretend that this sport isn't dangerous.
It is a dangerous sport. And then when you talk about danger, right? Yeah. You know, the riders take all sorts of risks.
Yep.
And you know, it's part of what they do. It's part of what they understand they do.
Yep.
They deal with this throughout the year. They fall off. They break shoulders, collarbones, anything. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, it's we show those crashes.
Yeah, and for whatever reason, because it's maybe someone's last moments, we shouldn't be lingering there. Or
yeah, look, it's I think with the Walter Weyland situation, I remember that night quite vividly. I'll never forget it, to be quite honest. It was pretty clear, just even from the vision, that when he hit the ground, that there was a problem. And you know, to the broadcaster's credit, the host broadcaster's credit, they did shift away from that very, very quickly. Mm. And then afterwards, while he was still on the road and they were attending to him, all the shots were just long shots from the chopper, because I know it was between the trees and that sort of thing. But there were no close-ups. But as we progress with the media coverage, we're going to see much more of this, because the coverage becomes much more intrusive. You know, the motos are right in the bunch in high def. Right, and we're going to see more of this now, I think, than we did in the past.
Mm. So. And it's particularly, I mean, Rob, you even mentioned things like onboard cameras. I mean, they're going to make, I think as that technology moves towards live technology, you know, we're probably going to see what even happened to the minutiae of a lot of these things.
I mean, that, you know, it was an onboard camera. Well, we had onboard camera vision of that crash at the Santo Stewart and Under. Which was just utterly spectacular. Both the fan shot vision from the side of the road, and also, I think, was it Jeremy Wah? His onboard vision of what was happening there. I mean, they were both spectacular. They gave you two different contexts. But what it did is it showed you just the absolute violence that happens in a situation like that at speed. And, you know, I think people need to really understand. I think it gave people a real understanding of exactly how these guys are dicing with danger on a daily basis, you know, just one touch of wheels.
Remember Jens Voigt crashed out of the Tour a few years ago and he had a similar face plant. Like, he really...
He was
really
messed up. I remember that.
Bad job of himself. And, when you see it, it's just so shocking. Hmm. But it's quite, I don't know, I guess it's like a football tackle that you don't want to see, you know, where they pick someone up and try and spear them into the ground. That just, that's just part of the gladiatorial aspect of sport.
Yeah, it's part of the drama. I mean, you look at, I remember speaking of the
tour. You don't want it.
No, but I think it might even have been, of course you don't want it. But equally, you know, when we talk about the fact that, you know, we linger on things like victory celebrations and, you know, winning and the champagne moments, I think you need to contrast that to the really low points. Mm. And I think often the athletes themselves maybe don't fully appreciate this in the sense that they obviously are looking at it and like, don't look at me while I'm suffering. But there is a point, like I think Michael Rogers' 2007 tour, for example, when he crashed on that descent and then he got back up and continued on, and then we saw that moment where he literally said, look, I'm done. And he got to the car and I think he just broke down in tears. And that sort of stuff is gold. I mean, it's...
Well, Contador last year.
Went, same thing.
And it involved Rogers, you know, when he went up and said, that's it, fellas. I'm really sorry, but I've got to go. Oh. That was, I think... At that point, people earned so much more respect for Contador. Hmm. And he became a bigger... even bigger superstar by abandoning the way that he did.
Yeah.
But that's getting away from Posse Vivo. I hope he recovers well. I hope.
Oh, he's fine. He's already talking about racing Tour de Suisse.
Yeah.
Right. So
I mean, it was a very lucky boy, and you know, it was a head injury, but it was probably the most mild head injury he could have had.
If you're gonna have one, that's the one to have. You know, he just had the deep gashes. I think everybody was really put off by the amount of blood, because he hit his head in a very specific way, which caused that to happen. Mm. So it looked worse than it really was in the end, because, you know, I mean, he's there being interviewed in the hospital the following day. Mm. Yeah. Piece of cake, you know, it's no problem. He's fully lucid.
Now, the other thing, two more things I want to talk about before we go on.
No, just quickly, in 2002 at the World Championships in Zolder, there was a crash in the under-19s, and Heinrich Hausler was involved, and so was a Salzburger. Don't think it was Wesley. Anyway, he literally slid across the finish line, the Tasmanian, and his teeth came through his lip, and it was on the photo finish camera, and it was horrendous footage. And I remember Kevin Tabata was the first on the scene, and he went over to say, "You'll be all right." And he as soon as he saw him, he ran into the gutter, had a vomit, went back, and then tended to his rider. So, in other words, people are influenced by horrific, horrendous crashes more than just the person involved.
No, exactly. I think it's very much a visceral reaction when you see some of these things. Let's talk about Matt Green Edge's first, the way they've attacked the first. I suppose this is something they've almost done in a signature way at Grand Tours now for a little while, which is look at a Grand Tour and go, okay, maybe we don't have the GC talent to go deep, but we do have the talent to really have impact on the first week, first 10 days. We saw last year at the Vuelta and at the Giro, even at the Tour, probably the year before when you're talking about the Tour. But the way they've had an impact in shaping those first few days, this year, case in point as well, is something that I think you'd have to put a lot of credit down to Matt White and the way he plans these races and the roster that he has. He's working the best. He's maximising the efficiency of what he's got.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's such a good motivator, and he gets these people, gets all the guys wound up, and then they wind each other up as well. And you can see how enthusiastic Simon Clark is. The guy's always got a ball of energy when he's on the podium. He's doing all of the team gestures to make sure that he gets Dan Jones the footage that he wants. There's such a great vibe in that team that when they win, it seems to roll through. So you get the team time trial win, then Michael Matthews' fantastic sprint, like just how he had the confidence to salute when he did before he crossed the line with everyone closing in on him was remarkable. But then if you put it into context, like last year they dominated the first few days as well. Then we printed a magazine, and by the end of the Giro, there were two of them left. Mm. Mm-hmm. So there were unfortunate circumstances. There were crashes, and it was a bit strange, and the weather, and people fell down. So anything can happen from now. But as riders say, when they win, the pressure's off us now. We've had a result. We've come here to achieve something. We've done that.
And now they have two goals left, which is to snag another stage. Mm-hmm. and to make sure they get they keep Chavez top 10 GC.
Mm. I mean, I think if he can...
That's it.
That'd be cool. I mean, especially seeing the footage with Chavez. He just is such a cool guy.
Yep.
I think... Did you see the footage with... who was catching that for SBS?
That would have
Dan.
I was going to say.
But he was up the Colombians, and it's super fun. It's super fun. I think Australians are really going to warm to him. Hopefully, he does end up.
He's a cheeky little character. Yeah.
Don't know. Dwell too much on the Aussies, but it was a fantastic first few days. In terms of the actual nature of the first, the GC at this point, we now have. You know, we've essentially created a very selective. First five stages, which has meant that the creme has already really risen. Contador is in pink, Fabio Aru is second, Richie Porte's third, but that you would, you know, going to the Giro, that we probably would have thought that would have been the hierarchy, or there, you know, not necessarily that order, but
yeah,
they're already there.
Yeah, and
are we going to go straight to GC now?
Sure.
Well, we're going to talk about quickly just about what they have done so far, and then we'll.
Yep. But there are 16 riders left within 2 minutes. So, you know, there's still a lot there. But when you look at the field, you look at the 16 who are inside that 2 minutes, the only other rider there, well, obviously you've got Cruisinger, who's sitting pretty. You've got and you've got Juran, who is probably likely to come back sometime in the third week if he gets over whatever it is that's bugging him. So, you know, in the end, yes, though, I think the three guys that we've seen.
What did you think of their performance just on the Abitone? I mean, it was really them in their own class, really.
Stage five.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought there were a lot of take-home points from about two kilometres worth in particular, just from about 5.5 kilometres to go when Contador attacked.
Yep.
We saw, first of all, that he was ready to do that.
Yep.
We saw Richie respond really patiently, beautifully, just sort of that Michael Rogers sort of just, you can
turn
hear
it up a little
that's
bit.
That's it, boys, just keep, you know, he can't maintain it. If you just roll through, you'll get there. And the fact that Richie chased him down in the big ring, that to me says a lot about him. That was at 8.4% at that moment in the race. And he seemed to do it with relative ease and not just catch up to him, but then sit on for a minute, and I think Contador.
He had a bit of a dig.
And then they had a little bit of a chat. You know, should we have dinner after this? You know, hold hands.
I heard San Gervais is quite around here.
Richie and Contador definitely had some words. I don't know if it was let's work together and get rid of this Italian, because Astana is all over us this first few days.
Well, they might have been thinking about a Colombian as well.
I don't know.
Rigoberto Urán. Yeah.
I don't know. I think that there seemed to be a little bit of a.
There's a whiff of desperation about Astana.
And then Richie attacked.
Yeah, yeah. And then
there is a whiff of desperation. Another thing I can take from that climb is that I was surprised to see how isolated Richie was. I really thought he would have more Sky guys around him. We saw Leopold Koenig at the top, at the front of the second chase group, but he didn't. He was never in support.
Koenig is one of those riders inside 2 minutes, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I agree with you, Rob, just to dwell on that. You know, the Sky haven't had a huge impact, which is interesting because in the first few days, you'd have to say that Tinkoff took up the bulk of responsibility when they needed to. So if anyone had an excuse to not be, you know, there or thereabouts, it was Tinkoff. They could have had maybe that day that they paid for. Sky feel like, I'm not sure what's going on.
I remember instances like this in the past where they were all over it. Remember when Froome won the stage in 2013 and Richie was second that day. And then the next day, Froome was absolutely isolated. Kenyon crashed. Richie had a shocker and different things. And Froome ended up getting there. And Movistar worked him over like within an inch of his life.
One of the
best
days of Tour de France racing in a long time.
It was fabulous. And that was, there was a little tastes of that in stage five of the Giro, where, okay, it just could have been that Sivsov was on a bad day because we saw him at the back of the second group. And normally he's just that Mr. Reliable, same with Vasily Kiryienka. He's there. Like a diesel.
This week, Kiryienka, as soon as the road goes uphill, he's just shot right out the back.
Mm.
It's like something's going on there. Mm.
So it seems the mobile home is working out well for Richard.
Maybe they should each have their own mobile home and maybe that'll help.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well,
might end up at being party headquarters down in the car park.
Let's before we talk about what is to come in the Giro, what do you guys make of that motorhome? Because I think that is definitely worth a small comment because it is something different, right? I mean, it's not... I think Rory Sutherland tweeted something interesting, which he was talking about, you know, oh, well, I'd love to be able to, it'd be more comfortable for me to stay with my wife and kids at home. But the nature of a grand tour is, you know, you are all there together doing it together. I mean, is there a point where your comforts maybe take a second sort of, you sit behind the team ethic and the team environment and keeping morale
maybe that's
together.
What's actually going on with Sky, right? Richie's got the pimpmobile. Mm. And the rest of the guys are in the hotel, and they're just going, I'm not going to work for you anymore.
No.
But do you
I think what is interesting is, I haven't spoken with Richie since stage five, but I know another Australian GC rider who, if he'd finished on his own without teammates in the Grand Tour, yeah. we would have heard all about it.
Yep.
I didn't have anyone with me. And you can assume who that might be, but... But Richie seems to rather than
may have been riding for BMC in the past.
He tends to go and rally the troops and say, "Okay, you weren't there today, but tomorrow." Well, I bet Sky's all over.
Well,
it tomorrow.
Here's the thing, right? It's like David and Matt and Hank and in the broadcast last night. Yeah, they agree with you in terms of, you know, not having that support, and they see it as a big danger for Port. But you know, maybe those guys are just kind of back ending the race. Maybe they looked at the stage and they thought, okay, yeah, Richie can cover this off because it wasn't really a super high mountain stage, and we'll let him take care of business, and then we'll be there when it counts on some of the other stages. Maybe that's what they're looking at. Maybe they don't really care about the rest of the guys losing time.
I mean, if there's anything to be said about someone like Kerrison, then maybe that is the case. Maybe they've gone, okay, you guys are, you know, Richie is just going to ride a passive but going to be up there role, and you guys sort of take it easy until we get to the second week.
Look, I think if we'd even seen like Henao or Sivsov or one of the others turn up at the base of that final climb with him, it would have been different. Mm. We don't expect Bernie Eisel to be there. You know, he does his work and does it in different ways. Mm. And the same with Elia Viviani, you know. Like, they've all got their roles. But I just think it was surprising that we didn't have one more with him, especially when there were five Astanas, five or six Tinkovs. There were some big, solid blocks of colour, and in the black with the blue line was one.
Yeah, if we went on Sky's past history, you would have expected to see Hanau, Kirienka combo, and Koenig there.
But I think that is the nature of it, because although we did sort of say the opposite going into the Giro, I do think that this is not the tour team, you know. This is not like a Col de Joux plan on the Critérium du Dauphiné a few years ago, where they literally just lined it out and it was four Sky riders going over the top together. I think this is a dynamic team, but I don't think we're going to see any sort of being Richie
but,
sort
but
of doing
see,
this sort
but
of
this, yeah, but this makes no sense to me. This makes no sense to me, because if you've got a rider like Port, who's clearly got some unbelievable form, right? You know, this is a team that's supposed to be able to plan for this, and this is something they planned for since the end of last season. Mm. You would make an assumption that they would send the A team or an A team.
Well, on
paper, they look like an A team.
Might have just been the equivalent of that strange stage.
Yeah, right.
Stage nine.
Okay.
All right, guys. Well, I suppose the proof will be in putting as the race unwind itself. Let's talk about what is to come, and we'll get there right after this. Well, we're heading into the race's first rest day. That comes next Monday in Europe. But before that, we've got some more hard data. It's going to be incredibly selective this first 10 days of the Giro d'Italia. And as I mentioned just before, Alberto Contador leads the race. He's 2 seconds clear of Fabio Aru, who has looked very, very good so far. And he's been, as we've mentioned, surrounded by Astana teammates. Richie Port third. Kreuziger, another guy who's ridden a very solid race, and someone who somehow just keeps on keeping on when dodging scandal after scandal. Dario Cataldo is fifth. Chavez sixth. Visconti seventh. Mikel Landa eighth. And a few other notable names. Rigoberto Urán, although he's lost some time, is 12th. And Darwin Adepuma, 16th. So there are a few other guys down a little bit further. And you certainly can't say the race is totally going to be about the top three. Those guys are all within 2 minutes. So, look, we've got 15 stages and some really hard ones in the last week. Mm. Let's just talk about the next week, though. Stage 7, for those that don't know, Grosseto di Fiuggi, is 264 kilometres. That is unbelievably long for a Grand Tour stage.
Didn't they make a rule? They did make a rule that 230 was the limit.
I know. So did what,
is that just a UCI rule that you just can ignore?
I guess. I don't know.
It is in the. I think it is in the rule book, actually. I think you're right. They shouldn't grant to us.
But they've done it for the last two or three years. Yeah. They chuck in a massive one.
But then it's not unusual for the Italians to sort of have a...
a wild card. I have 2 points about that stage.
Yep.
Right? One, how great has been the shorter stages in this part of the race? I think that's the future. Mm. Right? Stages under 200 kilometers. That's what we need in Grand Tours.
Yep.
And two, at stage seven of 264K, Adam Hansen.
Hmm. Well, that's definitely a possibility. He's the kind of guy that could do well. It's actually...
Agree?
He will come out. He had a go on his birthday. And he will have another go.
Think about that stage, though.
And he doesn't stop.
For those that haven't even maybe seen the Percorso, it's actually quite... It's not even that easy a stage. If you look at it, it's quite bumpy. It's going to really... The thing about the stages like this, and this has been mentioned, I think, by people, the tour in previous years as well, I think it was that 238-kilometre one a couple of years ago at the Tour. It's really long. It's unnecessarily fatiguing. And all it does is it takes away from what's to come. And if you look at the stages after that, there's two hard mountain stages. I don't know. Like, why have a stage like that? They're either going to turn off completely,
be a transfer, but I don't think that's the reason behind it. I don't know. Maybe they're just
want to try
a bit of everything.
If it is a transfer, it still seems like an excessive transfer. I mean, you can still cut it short a bit.
Jump in the car.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. So something like that I find quite frustrating.
If I look at that top 17 that we have in front of us, which brings us down to Damiano Cunego, a former winner from 11 years ago, but he's at 212. If I look at all of that list, I still have... Port ahead of Contador at the end because of that long time trial. Mm-hmm. And I think that the long time trial might be something that Richie was thinking about yesterday when they were going up that hill.
Right.
Because it was like, okay, I've got you covered on the climb. I don't need to actually put too much time into you because I'm going to... Unless Contador comes back and does a 2009 time trial, which, you know, he's likely to do. He could do it. But, you know...
He won't be a slouch he's on not the time be, trial.
No, he's not going to be a walk in the park for Richie to beat Contador, but no one else in that list has got the time trial credentials of Richie, certainly Richie in 2015.
Yep. It's almost a time trial that I'm really interested to see how it plays out because you don't... see time trial this long pretty much ever. I don't think the last one we would have seen like this would have been decades ago.
Probably Miguel Indurain and 64.5 kilometre.
Yeah, so
around.
The mid-90s basically. So it's been a long time and it could have a really big time gap. So, you know, you could be looking at sort of something which defines the race almost more than the mountains. I think they've said that, but I don't
absolutely.
Know. We'll
Let's
see.
Be clear because when we're talking about a time trial specialist like Richie taking time out of a climber, like... Well, let's say Aru. We're not talking about 20 seconds.
No.
We're talking 3, 4, 5 minutes. Look at Pierre Orland and those guys who have been up on GC in stage races in the past. The time trial comes along and they're 11th or 12th overall. You know, they drop right like a sinker.
Yep.
So we're talking massive gains can be made.
I mean, like, I think often...
It's 59.5 kilometres, the big time trial stage. 14.
Yep. Two to 3 seconds a kilometre isn't that crazy. So, you know, you're looking at that long, that's 3 minutes already. So, I mean, it does add up. It adds up very quickly. And it could put the race in a very, I don't know, it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out. But that's not until stage 14, I believe. Stage 13 or stage 14. Yep. But we've got a week's racing before that and, of course, the rest day. Guys, anything else worth looking out before we wrap it all up?
I think the big shame of the Giro, like it's been great and I think it's still going to be a fabulous race, but I think after what we saw in that stage five mountaintop finish is that there's three guys racing for the title. You'd like to think that Urán might improve, something's gone awry there. You'd like, you know, Visconti, he's been animated and he's had big success at the Giro in the past, but he's going to lose bucket loads of time. There's like a whole host of guys who might make it a little bit interesting, but it's really Contador report on the podium unless something really funky happens.
Yeah. Well, I think anything's decided at this point. It's
it is the Giro. Things do get funky.
Yeah,
hey,
exactly.
Man, it could be a breakaway and it stays away for 20 minutes. Who knows?
That could be.
Well, on that 264 state, 264 kilometer
Well, I mean,
stage.
You know, that is very much, it would be a Richie, right in the line of Richie Port's first year.
Yeah,
so some
that's
sort
right.
of strange symmetry.
Spot of bad weather, boom, all of a sudden the race is different.
Who knows?
Anyway, we will see, we will see. All right, guys, thank you for joining us. Been good as always, and I'm licking my lips at the next week of the Giro before we meet again.
Thanks for having us on board. It was, we could have talked evidently a lot longer, but we seem to jump around and talk about the Giro.
All right, Phil, good to see you.
I got nothing.
You got nothing. All right. Thanks for joining us. For news, blogs, videos, pics and more, we're always online creating more content at sbs.com.au/cyclingcentral, and you can find this podcast on soundcloud.com/cycling-central. That is it. Bye for now. Farewell and goodbye.